Welcome to Fear or Favour, our first ever podcast. My name's Mark Williams-Thomas. I'm a former police detective turned investigative reporter. And you may know some of my programmes. I was the man that exposed Jimmy Savile on my ITV documentary. I have a series on Netflix called The Investigator, and I'm currently working on a number of projects. I have known this man for a very long time, and he is one of the best in the country. I will let him introduce himself.
I'm Nazir Afzal, and I was Chief Crown Prosecutor for the North West of England. Prior to that, Director of Prosecutions in London. I have dealt with serious organised crime, fraud, violence against women for 25 years. I was then Chief Executive of the Police and Crime Commissioners, and I've spent a whole career in justice. And I've worked with Mark on many of the programmes he's been involved in, and I've also been one of those expert heads that you see on documentaries about all sorts of things, which quite frankly, some of them I don't know anything about, but that's by the by. But more importantly, the subject that we talk about, me and Mark, I'm very familiar with.
So let's just set the context. We're going to get as quickly as possible into the main subject we're talking about today. But the reason we're talking together is we're both outspoken. We've both quite an experience in our area of expertise. But what we wanted to do is to bring really a raw view to the audience so that those people who are listening really get to understand what is behind the cases that we're going to talk about, and more importantly, raise some of those perhaps areas that people are too scared to talk about.
And I think we need to say at the outset that everybody apart from Epstein is innocent until proven guilty. And we will often use the word alleged, and that means that something hasn't been tested in court. And so you must always remember that they are innocent until proven guilty.
So let's get straight into it. So our first case on Without Fear or Favour is Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell and Prince Andrew. Let's start with Epstein and Maxwell. So just a little bit of background. Epstein is arrested in July 2019 and he's charged with sex trafficking and conspiracy to engage in sex trafficking. He pleads not guilty. He's remanded in custody. But prior to his trial, he commits suicide. At least that's how it is reported. And we can talk a little bit more about that in due course. Let's set the scene in relation to Maxwell. She's currently accused. She's in custody awaiting trial. And she's accused of being a procurer of girls for Epstein. She's arrested on July the 2nd, 2020. And she is facing multiple charges of sexual abuse of young girls with Jeffrey Epstein. She's charged initially with six counts, including transportations of minors for purpose of sexual activity and conspiring to entice minors to travel. All of these relate to activities with Jeffrey Epstein, and she's been further charged now with sex trafficking of a minor. She has pleaded not guilty, and she vigorously denies all of the charges. Her lawyers have very clearly said that she is entitled to the presumption of innocence until such time as she has been through her court process. That is the background to both Epstein and Maxwell. And we can talk a little bit about how they came together. But Nazir, what is your take currently on in relation to both of those? Obviously, Epstein is now dead, but Maxwell?
At its heart, we're talking about people in power who have groomed very vulnerable people, invariably young women and girls, and who have passed them around. That's what trafficking basically is. And we know that obviously Epstein will never face a trial given his death. But back in the day, 10, 12 years ago, he was convicted of trafficking and child sex cases. And he did a deal with the prosecution, which meant that he served less jail time than he would otherwise. So what we are now dealing with is what should have been dealt with back then, i.e. the associates of Jeffrey Epstein. It was, I think, quite lazy of the American prosecutors back then to simply accept that Jeffrey Epstein was the only man that they could or should prosecute.
Why do you think that happened? Why do you think they did a deal and why didn't they go after the other people back then?
I think one has to think about why a justice system works the way it does, that you have loads of other cases. We're talking about at the time of the financial crash. So prosecutors were heavily engaged in dealing with those matters as well. And they do go for low-hanging fruit. And Jeffrey Epstein and what he was then accused of was low-hanging fruit. And the fact that he was prepared to do a deal, which meant that prosecutors could tick an enormous box and say that's the end of the matter, was clearly something that played on their minds. And they wanted to move on from Epstein and focus on other prosecutions that they would have to potentially deal with at the time. So I think it was just simply, as I said, laziness, but also pragmatism. What limited resources you have, you use for what you can prosecute rather than what you may, if you carry out a more thorough investigation, turn up.
But let's be very clear. Epstein was a very powerful man back then. And even when he died, you know, he was very well off financially. He obviously connected with lots of people in very high social circles. How much of an influence? Because it's very easy, isn't it? You know, people will be listening to this and the public in general will have a thought thinking, yeah, but hang on a minute. Did he do that deal? And was that deal done because he was so powerful to protect other people and to keep it quiet?
I think we can conclude that, yes, that was a significant part of it, because when we move on to talking about Maxwell, she refers to the detail of that deal that was done. And the deal seemed to reflect not just on Epstein's criminality, but on that of his associates. So why not go after his associates? Well, clearly they chose not to. So were his associates really powerful people, as we seem to think that they may be now? So I have no doubt, Mark, that that would have played a part. Do you want to shake that tree? They decided at that time not to shake that tree.
And before we move on to Maxwell, what is your thought? Obviously, he goes into jail, and we know that people by that stage, he was looking at a jail term, which was not going to see him come back out again. Do you have any thoughts that perhaps there was something sinister involved?
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I tend to think about people using conspiracies to mask their incompetence.
Absolutely.
And I think that what was happening in that remand center was incompetence. People not looking at cameras, not carrying out their due diligence, their searches, all of the things that you would expect on somebody who is who's on suicide watch. So I personally believe, as you've just alluded to, he faced the rest of his life in prison. He also had enormous pressure to name other people potentially. And that must have been a burden that would have perhaps led to him deciding to take his life. But of course, he could have been saved if the authorities had done what they normally do for Suicide Watch. I have little doubt that they could have prevented him from harming himself. But as I say, I'm a firm believer that what we're dealing with here is incompetence rather than conspiracy.
Let's talk a little bit about Maxwell, and we'll talk about Epstein more because they are linked together so closely. Maxwell comes from a very well-known family, from a media mogul, Robert Maxwell, who himself has a very interesting and checkered past and, of course, died in very strange circumstances. But Maxwell herself, she socialized with Epstein, particularly in the 1990s and through that era, and she became his girlfriend. And it was their relationship that got the contact with high-profile other individuals. She was arrested and she's currently facing trial. What's your thought as a prosecutor in relation to her fairness? I mean, can she get a fair trial? Whether or not that's right, you know, she may well be absolutely right that she's in jail for the rest of her life. But let's sit on the fence a minute and look at the aspect. So much media attention.
There will be a two-week period in which they will select a jury. The Americans have a very different approach to prosecution than we do. We, as you know, we have reporting restrictions, contempt laws. Nobody's allowed to know the evidence until the evidence is heard in court. Nobody's allowed to speculate about the case or talk about the case here in the UK. In the United States, all of that is being rehearsed openly and publicly. But with the whole concept of jury selection, in America with a population of 350 million people, they should be able to find 12 people who are fair-minded. They'll also have alternates as well. So I'm not too concerned about her being able to get a fair trial. I think the American system copes with high-profile prosecutions, probably because they prosecute more high-profile people. I have a problem in the UK that we tend to shy away from prosecuting high-profile people for all sorts of reasons. But in the United States, they have if you think about it, what happened with the financial crash? We had in the UK one prosecution of one banker. The Americans put all these enormously successful bankers in prison. So they have a tried and tested approach to ensuring that people get a fair trial.
I find that interesting, Nazir. So why do you think that is? Why do you think the Americans are more likely to go after high-profile, influential people than the British?
Well, you know, we've called our podcast Without Fear or Favour for a reason, is that we endeavour to operate without fear or favour here. In America, they do operate without fear or favour. And they have lots of grades of prosecutors. So if the state prosecutor or district prosecutor can't prosecute a case, the federal prosecutor can step in, you know? So there are all sorts of people who potentially can get involved in a prosecution. And perhaps the most important thing, Mark, is their ability to turn witnesses, which we can't do. You know, they are able to offer immunity from prosecution on a daily basis. Over here,
and they do that as well, don't they? They do that.
Over here, it's a big deal. I mean, I've done maybe one or two in my whole career, whereas in America, they'll do one or two an hour. You know, and so they have this principle: he who comes first gets the best deal. So,
Why don't we do that? Stay with that, Nazir. I think that's really interesting. Why don't we do that? If we've got some massive case, you know, murders or child abuse, something that's really significant, why are we not looking to turn witnesses to get convictions?
Because we think we are fairer. And we think that everybody's entitled to a fair trial, and you shouldn't put pressure on people by saying to them that if we were to prosecute you, you will get this length of time in jail. So therefore, you're incentivized to accept a plea earlier and to maybe turn and give evidence against somebody else. We think that that's unfair, which is a ridiculous principle, quite frankly. Because, the Americans, are you saying that the American system is not fair? Are you saying that many other Commonwealth systems are not fair because they operate in the same way as the American system? I think we would be able to bring many more very powerful people to justice if we were in a position to say that you will get the best deal if you come forward with your evidence. And additionally, the other thing that we have is we have an independent judiciary who can actually tell our prosecutors, we won't accept that deal. In America, though, all the judge does is rubber stamp the prosecutor's deal. So that's why nobody will do a deal with us in the UK, because there's no guarantee the judge will say, okay, right, I accept that. The judge can, and very often, sadly, Mark, will say, nah, not doing this deal. We will have the trial. So the witness doesn't feel that he has or she has a guarantee of a deal in the UK. In America, they do have a guarantee of a deal, and that makes an enormous difference.
That is absolutely. I suppose I hadn't really thought about it to such a degree of how significant and important that is. You often talk to I talk to offenders, and they'll say to me, a chit was put before the judge, to offer a slight benefit, but it's never really official, and it's all very much done behind the back. And if we made it more official, would it cause more people when they're in trouble themselves? But as you say, the risk, I suppose, is that they're going to give you something simply to get themselves off. But isn't that down to the ability of the investigators and the prosecutors to test that evidence so that
Absolutely.
They aren't using weak evidence?
There are so many occasions, Mark, when somebody, I know that somebody's up to no good and they're prepared to plead to a lesser offence. And we'll say, no, we're going to prosecute you to the nth degree because we know that our evidence will show that you are guilty of multiple murders or something really heinous, whereas they all plead guilty to assisting an offender. So, people can use their judgment and should use their judgment, but they're not allowed to use their judgment in the UK. And I think that's a real flaw in our system, which means that the powerful do get away with murder.
So obviously Maxwell now is facing trial. There's a lot of information that's going to come out during that case. I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of, do you think it's better or worse for her that Epstein isn't around?
That's a moot point, but absolutely. I think that if Epstein was around, Epstein would probably take all responsibility and minimize Maxwell's role. So actually, his not being around, I think, does not do her any good at all, because she's got nobody. She can, she will undoubtedly want to taint him as the Mr. Big, responsible for it all. I played a little part. She'd even say, I'm pretty sure, that I'm a victim too. And she can prey on that because he's not around. Were he to be around, given my sense about the relationship between the two of them, I think he would take responsibility more and therefore minimize her involvement, her culpability, so to speak. So I think that she's lost that ability. But at the same time, the other side of the coin is that she can blame him for everything and he can't come back and say, no, it was you.
Do you think he would have protected her? Because would that be through to love or what? Because what's the benefit for him?
The relationship was 20 years long. It was way before the offending allegedly started in the mid-90s, and their relationship started a decade before that. And so I think their relationship was very strong. And when he did the deal back in 12, 13 years ago, that deal was also intended to protect her and his quote-unquote associates. So he was really keen to do that then. I would have thought he would do so now. So their relationship was very strong. People don't know this, but I'm the only person in the world to have ever prosecuted Ghislaine Maxwell for drink driving.
And did you?
In 1996. She was driving in central London. She was over the limit. She was stopped by Belgravia police officers. She told them she didn't have an address. So this is how charming she is. She charmed the officers to take her to where she was staying and made them cups of tea.
No.
she appeared at Horsfield Road Magistrates Court the next day. I was prosecuting then. She told the court she was an internet professional, which for 1996 was a big deal. I didn't know there was such a thing as an internet professional. And she told people that she was traveling internationally, which is why she didn't have an address. And this was in the midst of a criminality that we're now dealing with. So I saw somebody that was really charming. I saw somebody that was able to charm police officers, which may not be so difficult. But, as a police officer, you may think that may not happen. But so I think that... I suspect that you will see a very charming woman who will come across as somebody that was in the rapture of this particular person, that she wasn't able to speak up, speak out. As I said, that she may claim that she herself was a victim of him and prey on the.
And how much of that do you buy, Nizia? How much do you buy the none of it? Good.
Absolutely none of it. I've dealt with this is grooming, but on an international scale. And I've dealt with, grooming cases in the UK. And what she has done, and this happens quite frequently, actually, Mark, is male groomers, maybe even a gang of male groomers, will often identify a woman because that woman is able to bring victims to them. Because the victims will have more faith and trust in a woman than they would do in a man. And so that is, looking at what's happening here, Ghislaine Maxwell is that woman who in the old days we'd call it a pimp. But, what she has done is she uses her charms to find young girls, to manipulate them, to tease them, to give them what they need, what they think they need, money, whatever it might be. And then when they are trapped, in the middle of a spider's web, she then introduces them to all of these men, particularly Epstein, but potentially also his other associates.
I mean, it's so similar, isn't it? In the UK, the cases of Fred and Rose West, the serial killers, and actually it's very clearly documented that Rose went out with Fred on the trips, and it was actually her that encouraged the girls to come with them because the girls were much more likely to get in the car. And that was a discussion between Fred and Rose, much more likely to get in the car if Rose went and got them. And of course, that naturally is common sense, isn't it? If you've got a young girl walking out there and if a woman goes up to them compared to a man, they're going to feel much more relaxed and calmer. And so therefore, Maxwell provided that safety element that the girls thought they had. Well, she's a woman, she's going to look after me, compared to Epstein, and of course used it totally to his advantage.
I will forever now see Maxwell and Epstein as the Fred and Rose of East America. Yeah, absolutely, I think exactly that. This is their MO. This is what was happening, and she was able to attract, manipulate the most vulnerable people, young girls. When people say to me, oh, you know, they're over 16 and they can consent. Well, you know, we said that about girls here in the UK. Their consent was bought through duress. It was bought through blackmail. It was bought through threats. And that's exactly what was happening here. So once you've captured them, and once you're now being abused, now, the men are now abusing them, you then say to them, well, yeah, you can't possibly tell the police because, one, you're scared of us, but two, you've been involved in low-level drug taking or some other criminality. Therefore, you will face consequences. And there is no way that those girls are going to speak up and speak out. And so when people say, why has it taken 10 or 20 years? That's always what happens. They rarely report immediately. They take their time because they're scared to death of repercussions, of victimization, of threats, and who can they trust? If Epstein is as powerful as we think he may have been, how can you trust a senior police officer who might be engaged with him in some way? Absolutely, they were scared to death, and that's why it's taken two decades for them to come forward.
And do you think some of that, obviously, my involvement in terms of Jimmy Savile and obviously your work around the child exploitation, there has been a tidal shift in the last 5 years or so around child protection, child abuse. And I think it's transcended across the globe. Other countries, it's reflected in as well. We've had Harvey Weinstein, whoever thought that a man as powerful as that would finally be brought to justice. Do you think, because I do, I think that, and it's not about claiming credit. I think what's happened is attitudes have changed and we've started to listen to victims and we've started to give them a voice. And as a direct result of that, even the most powerful, and people would often say to me, and we still say it now, but hang on a minute, why do you go after the most powerful? Why do you go after Savile? Why did you go after Max Clifford, Rolf Harris? My response to that is it's always the same, is that if the most powerful can be taken down, then that makes everybody touchable.
Absolutely right. The teachers, the doctors, the next door neighbors, the people that you meet in your lives who are abusing will feel they can act with impunity because you're not going after the big fish, the popular, the most powerful individuals in society. Once you start going after the Savils of this world, then you are sending out a message to every offender and abuser that there's no hiding place for you. And I think that's why it's important. And that's why Epstein and Maxwell's important for the American authorities and for us, for that matter, because it sends out a message that it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter how well connected you are, it doesn't care how much money you have. At the end of the day, you cannot buy your way out of justice. And you made a very good point about listening. What we were really, really rubbish at is listening to victims. Until maybe about a decade ago, then once we started listening, they all came forward because they realized finally the state is prepared to do something about these people. But we were eyes closed, ears closed for generations, quite frankly, and that's why we've let down so many people in the past.
And in terms of Maxwell and Epstein, their association, do you think we're going to get to know the totality of it? Or do you think it's far greater than perhaps what the authorities even know?
They say that they have journals and diaries. So it's not just the evidence of the women who are giving evidence. There are witnesses. they say that there is evidence that we will hear that we haven't heard thus far. So I imagine there'll be, you know, flight details, stuff like that, which may give us more knowledge than we have right now. Whether it leads to somebody else is another matter. And of course, what comes out in court is not bound by the libel laws. So, I suspect there are really powerful people rather worried about the trial on 29th of November because, yeah, what if she were to name, or prosecutors were to name, you know, A, B, C, D, and E, they cannot sue the court for besmirching their name. This is evidence that's coming out in a courtroom. So the question I ask, and I'm not, this is, I don't know the answer to, is whether or not she will do a deal. Because the possibility is that there's pressure being put on her, not by her own legal team, not just by her own legal team, not just by the prosecution, but by some of these other networks, these other connectors, who might say
to her...
Other offenders, absolutely. Who'll say, actually, you plead guilty, we will look after you, you will get you'll be able to come out of jail before you die, we'll look after anybody that you care about, et cetera, et cetera. But the last thing we want, Ghislaine Maxwell, is for our name to be mentioned in that courtroom. But if you do a deal, then the script is written as to what you are pleading to. The names of who you are pleading to will be in that document, et cetera, et cetera. And that protects us. So I think there is an inordinate amount of pressure on her, whether she folds or not. Is really an answer a question I can't answer. But that pressure is there as well. So,
and where do you think those people come from? Where do you think those people come from?
They are going to be the people on those flight schedules. They're the people who went to Epstein Island or whatever it's called. They're the people who, some of them have been named publicly, and they are wealthy, powerful figures. Not just American, but mainly American. And that, I think, is, including, former politicians, certainly people in the media, people in tech, in industry, in business. We are talking the who's who of American life, I guess. And the last thing they want, Mark, is to have their name mentioned in a courtroom. And of course, there is, again, what I said earlier on about conspiracies, and I don't believe in them, there is some talk, some people have already died over this, that people have been killed in the past to prevent them speaking up about this particular network. So there's a lot at stake.
How powerful do you think this network is? I mean, when it's always a very difficult one, and like you, I've investigated many individuals and many small groups of paedophiles, and what we know by and large is paedophiles operate in isolation and alone. It's majority are in their bedroom, or they operate within a small capacity within a family environment. But there are obviously those who do operate as a group, the Operation Orchid, Sidney Cook, those people like that, the really nasty child abductors, abduct boys, sexually abuse them and then murder them. But the likes of Maxwell and Epstein, how far do you think they go? I mean, do you think they are part of a network which has suppressed evidence to the degree that people have been killed?
I personally think that is a possibility. Maybe not a probability, but certainly a possibility, because they didn't think they would ever be caught. They thought
because they were so powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. They're so powerful. They're beyond the reach of the law. Therefore, we can work as a network. We can connect. We can abuse the same girl together, that kind of stuff, which is a completely different model to the one you've just described. And that the only reason for that is because they thought they were above it all. And there was no way they would ever be brought to justice, certainly not by Epstein. And I think they were emboldened when Epstein did the deal back in the late 2008-09, because their name didn't come out then. So they felt that there's never, ever going to be an opportunity for them to be named. And so I'm pretty sure that they know each other, unlike most of the paedophile networks that you and I have dealt with.
So that means that there are very senior people in the judiciary who have aided Epstein and others during the years that have passed to ensure that they are not prosecuted and their details don't come out.
Arguably true. I mean, you buy your escape before you enter that room. And their escape was to ensure that there were people in power, in positions of responsibility, who they could turn to if they were ever going to be questioned. And I think they too will be shaking in their shoes right now as to what it is that might come out in the weeks and months ahead.
So let's take that one step further. So Maxwell knows that if she's found guilty on these charges, she will go to prison for a very long time. I always think it's very interesting when you have American prison sentences which amount to hundreds of years. It's like, well, people don't live hundreds of years. I always find that a very strange basis. But use that. So she goes to, she's found guilty, off she goes to jail, and she's going to languish there for a very long time. If she does a deal to protect other people, the question is, of course, is how much will that enable her to have a reduced sentence, or will she still be there for a very long time?
I think it'll make a significant difference, Mark.
Significant difference.
Because she's looking at a minimum of 25 to life, and you know that life can be life in America, more often than not, actually. But a deal could be in single figures. You know, depending on what she gives, depending on who she will name and who she potentially will give evidence against if they prosecute those individuals, she could be looking at 5 to 10 years in jail, of which she has served 2 years or thereabouts on remand. So she could actually walk out of court at the end of this calendar year, a free lady, so long as she is prepared to give evidence against these more senior offenders, so to speak. And I think, you know, that's quite an incentive.
So there's two elements, isn't there? So she, but there's an element that works for the prosecution and there's an element that doesn't work for the prosecution. So the aspect is, if these really powerful people say, right, plead to some of this to keep us out of it, and she does a plea bargain deal with the prosecution to keep the most powerful out, but accept other cases, or she turns completely and gives evidence against everybody, totally assisting the prosecution. One, of course, potentially gives more favour than the other, but both of them are pretty dynamite, aren't they, rather than just simply facing the music.
Absolutely right. I mean, she can be, you know, somebody that will bring down the house of cards, or she can just introduce them to a few jokers and a couple of kings, you know. But yeah, you know, that's her choice. You know, whether or not she wants 20 years in jail.
It's a pretty powerful choice to have.
You've got to also factor, going back to what we said about Epstein earlier on, does she think that she'll have a life? If these people are as powerful as some people think they may be, you know, you walk out of prison, you're given a new identity potentially. You're living somewhere completely away from everywhere else. Does witness protection amount to witness protection? And so she's got to balance a number of factors. I don't know the answer. I don't know whether she'll want to do any of this. Currently, her legal team are just focusing on legal obstacles, trying to make this case go away by suggesting that there ought not to be a trial at all because of legal reasons. But at some point, they will lose all of those arguments. Then the time comes as to what she chooses, because it'll be her choice alone, she chooses to do.
Because if she sends some very powerful people to prison, she will forever be in fear, I strongly believe, of those people. You know, those people, if they are as powerful as that, have very strong and very long tentacles to be able to reach out to people. And, you know, her father's vanished and disappeared and died. Same for her, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot to win and a lot to lose for Ghislaine Maxwell. But as I said, initially, right now, her legal team is just focusing on the legal niceties of this case, whether or not there ought to be a trial at all. My take on that is that they'll lose all of those technicalities. And then so nearer the 29th of November, she will have a decision to make. It won't be her, you know, at the end, it's her decision. But I mentioned earlier on about all the actors that are surrounding her, and whether or not their impact or their input will have a part to play in it. But we shall see.
Well, as we push closer to the trial, and certainly the trial, we'll give you a podcast around that. And I think that will be very interesting. It'll be interesting to see how our thoughts play out. But we can't talk about Maxwell and Epstein without talking about the most powerful person who features in this, certainly from the UK point of view, and that is Prince Andrew.
The Duke of York, His Royal Highness, who's... Since the interview with the BBC a year ago, has been at the forefront of conversations, and then 2-3 months ago, to his great shock and to our great shame, Victoria Roberts Dufresne, the alleged victim, began a civil action against him. So there, I suspect there he was thinking this case will go away, and now not only is the potential of his name coming up in the criminal action against Maxwell, but it has already come up in the civil action that Victoria Roberts Dufresne has brought. And, we learned only this week, for the third time, that the Metropolitan Police will not investigate this matter, with all of the all of our concerns about that issue. But that's by the by. The point is that a civil action will proceed. Victoria Roberts Dufresne has been very clever, and her legal team, because they brought the action in New York. The Americans have a statute of limitations. So abuse that went on 10, 20, 30 years ago, allegedly, cannot be sued about. However, the American New York governor brought in a law a couple of years ago, the Victims Act, which basically said, in a short, small window, this window of 12 to 18 months, it was extended to 2 years. If you have an allegation, and which we used to call historic, but we now call non-recent, you can bring it. And so she decided to bring her action in New York and take advantage of that law to deal with the statute of limitations argument. So Prince Andrew now faces a civil action where pretty much everything that Victoria Roberts Dufresne has said or will say will be heard in a court of law. And that it won't go away. It won't go away regardless of what the Metropolitan Police have decided to do in England or what Maxwell might decide to do in New York.
So let's just give a quick summary. So she's made the allegation that around 2001, when she was with Epstein and Maxwell, they had contact with Prince Andrew. She talks about an occasion when she was taken to a London club and plied with drink. She also talks about other occasion when she was taken to New York and to Epstein's private island. And she says, aged 18, she had an orgy with 9 girls and the prince was present. The prince says that all the allegations are false, without foundation, and that he denies fully any sexual contact with her. Of course, the allegation is that he is alleged to have forced to have sexual intercourse with her. The interview that he gave to the BBC was very telling, and two elements came out of that which I thought were very interesting. Firstly, he denies ever having met Virginia, but more importantly, of course, he says that he doesn't regret his friendship with Epstein. And I find that very interesting, given the fact that he has had this relationship for many years. And even after he went to jail, Epstein, and did that deal, the prince met him in in New York, and they went around and spent time together. This is a man who still stays after that in contact with Epstein and is friends with him. As you say, this isn't going to go away. The information this week from the Metropolitan Police, and I know that you tweeted about it, and it's interesting. I see your tweets and I think to myself, gosh, I would have said that, or I said that. And then you think to yourself, I can't just RT everything that Nazir says and says, I agree, that's totally on. But I thought the point that you made was spot on, is that we have this very interesting exercise that the Metropolitan Police, they've kind of coined it, but other forces use, is a scoping exercise. So they do this kind of scoping exercise prior to starting an investigation. And the point is, and it's like everything, I always have a very bizarre conversations often with senior officers. When senior officers said to me, well, we're going to close that case because there's no suspects. And you like go, yeah, but hang on a minute. If you don't investigate it, how do you know there's no suspects? Because you have to investigate it to identify whether there are any suspects. Take fingerprints, speak to witnesses. That will give you the suspects. And if you equate that across to this, it's the same. It doesn't matter whether it's a burglary, a theft, or serious sexual offences. Unless you investigate it, you do not know whether or not there are offences there.
It's shocking. I mean, it's a terrible lack of judgment on the part of the police. And it's actually what they always used to do. And we thought they've changed. Now, is it resources? Do they carry out the scoping exercise or review exercise because they only have a certain number of resources? And is that the reason why? I don't think so. I think who he is has had a significant part to play in the decision not to properly investigate it. And you know, and I know this from sex offending generally, is that when you investigate one, no predator I've ever dealt with, Mark, and you may think the same, has ever just focused on one person. You know, that the whole concept of a predator is they go wherever the vulnerable victim is. So I have no doubt that if they were to properly investigate, and Prince Andrew, of course, would have had royal protection officers who would have been with him pretty much all the time. And, you know, some of them are no longer in the Met, so, you know, what's their evidence? There would have been logs. There would have been, there will be an enormous amount of documentary evidence, potentially CCTV evidence, all of which can either exonerate him or lead to, potentially more victims coming out. So I think the Met have done themselves no favours by simply saying that we will not investigate. They haven't done victims any favours across the board. And, of course, there's something else complicating here is that the American defence attorney for Maxwell has said to the American court, anything that involves the UK should not be dealt with in the United States. It should be dealt with in the UK. The UK authorities seemingly have said, we will not investigate this matter. It should be dealt with in the US. So these victims, particularly Victoria, are stuck somewhere in the Atlantic, not knowing, nobody wants to deal with it, which is an absolute shocker. And I think, you know, they need to do this. If they won't do it, well, the civil action will bring it out anyway. And it'll demonstrate how poor the decision-making has been. And, you know, your bigger point about Prince Andrew and his lack of judgment. You know, what we learned, I know you just told us what you learned from that BBC interview. What I learned is, one, he doesn't sweat. And two, he was in the Pizza Express in Woking. Yes. How you can remember? Do you remember what you were doing yesterday? I have no idea what restaurant I was in 2001. You know, so if anything, you know, it has just added fuel to the fire.
And let me try this with you, there. So here's an interesting one. So Prince Andrew takes the book. He's in the box, and he says, when you ask him and say, "Do you know a lady called Virginia Roberts
Dufresne,
and he turns around and says, no, I've never met her at all. And you pull out a photograph, which you produce and you show to the juror and the jury and yourself. Take me from there. What are you going to say to him now?
Well, I know he's already said it, hasn't he? He said that it's been photoshopped, which is interesting because, you know, the idea... Back in 2001 or whatever it was, 2001, we didn't have the technology we have now. I have no doubt that you could show through forensic testing that photograph was from that time and that it wasn't photoshopped. And there will be witnesses, there will be other people. I think Victoria Roberts Dufresne's family have said that we know exactly where that was, location-wise. So it's not the photograph on its own is not all that we have. You know, we will be able to stand it up and say, right. And of course, the problem with being so open about saying that I've never, ever met her is if a prosecutor can show beyond reasonable doubt that photograph is genuine, then you've lied about the photograph. What else have you lied about?
Yeah.
It destroys your credibility. Mm. You know, what I would have, if I was Prince Andrew's advisors, I would have said something like, I can't remember. You know? Yeah.
He's created a massive problem for himself, because out of all the people that, so normal Joe Public, of course, when you say to them, have you been somewhere? And they say, well, no, I can't remember whether I've been there. And there's no CCTV, you're stuck. But what we've got here is a man who is constantly, almost constantly followed by security. And therefore, he may not know where he was, although he very clearly remembers he was in a pizza restaurant. Other people protecting him will know. He has a diary. He has a personal officer who knows absolutely where he is. His personal secretary knows where he is all the time. So he's either, well, there's a number of options. He's either absolutely telling the truth. None of this is true. It's all made up. Or he knows that he's never going to get prosecuted. He's going to be forever protected. And therefore, he can say what he wants.
Yeah, absolutely. He's innocent until he's ever proven guilty, and therefore everything that we think we know is not true. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is as you say, a 100% belief that nobody is going to bring him to justice. That nobody will either investigate it, or if it is investigated, that everybody will, there'll be a code of omerta. Nobody will speak, a bit like the mafia, nobody will speak, and nobody will give evidence, etc., etc. Now, that might be true again of the United States, of the United Kingdom. But we've discussed about the United States of America that they have the ability to prosecute you for perjury, for example. They prosecute for obstructing justice. They have a wider set of alleged offending than we have. If you've been asked to attend a police interview in New York State and you choose not to, and they get a warrant for that, you've committed an offence by not attending. You know, so there are other options open to the American authorities that we don't necessarily have. But as I say, he didn't do anything at all, or he must have a total faith in the fact that everybody will back him up.
And of course, there's a fundamental problem here, is that the Crown bring charges. It is the Crown that bring a case.
Yeah.
And of course, who is the head of the Crown and who is Regina? And that is his mother.
But somebody mentioned that he might have sovereign immunity. Only the sovereign has sovereign immunity, i.e. only Her Majesty the Queen can get away with murder, to put it bluntly. He doesn't get sovereign immunity. Then somebody suggested that he was a trade envoy for the UK government at the time, and therefore he's entitled to diplomatic immunity. These are lovely technicalities, none of which will stand up in a court of law. So we'll see what he comes up with. He hasn't got a leg to stand on in terms of a legal obstacle to being prosecuted. The only obstacle is the evidence, and somebody needs to investigate that. And as I said, if the UK authorities don't, the danger is that something will come out in the American civil action or in the American criminal prosecution that will potentially lead to a prosecution over there.
But where does this end? So no criminal prosecutions in the UK. The Metropolitan Police have made that very clear. There is obviously this civil action against Prince Andrew. But we've got now a debate in terms of whether or not that will take place because of the argument about it should take place in the US and not in the UK. Ultimately, it is still very possible that Prince Andrew will just simply walk away with this and nothing will happen.
Absolutely. I mean... and if he's done nothing, that's the right decision. He has to toss a coin, really. We don't know what Ghislaine Maxwell's going to say. We don't know where the tentacles of that network are going to go. We don't know whether any of the associates of Jeffrey Epstein might turn against him if they have evidence against him. We don't know whether or not any of the protection officers or the evidence witnesses over here potentially finally decide to speak up or are forced to do so by an American court, for example. So there are too many imponderables. There are too many uncertainties, which will ensure, I think, that Prince Andrew will learn to sweat.
Well, it's certainly something that's going to continue over the next few months and maybe much longer than that. We're going to try and keep our podcast to an hour so that the listener, you know, can really absorb and take it all in. Before we go, let's just talk a little bit about next week. We're going to talk about Wayne Cousins and Sarah Everard. And this is something that has not only gripped the public's attention because of the horrific nature, but it's also now having a ripple effect in relation to not just the Metropolitan Police's actions, but also wider in terms of women's safety.
Yeah, 100%. I've written about this. I wrote about it in the Daily Mail, of all places. I think this is a Stephen Lawrence moment. I think that women who make up the majority of this country and are really concerned about their safety, and not just their safety in relation to a sex offending or violence against women or domestic abuse generally, which they all always have been, but also in relation to the police and what the police's role is. We've got a situation, Mark, where the conviction rate for rape is nearly an all-time low, whereas 5 years ago it was an all-time high. How's that happened? We've lost, as we know, 500,000 years of policing experience. We've had reports only yesterday or 2 days ago of 2,000 officers being investigated nationally for sexual harassment or allegations involving witnesses or victims. We've had 1,000 officers in a separate investigation having been investigated over the last 5 years for inappropriate social messaging. We've got officer right now charged with rape facing trial. So there is a real concern that the police cannot be trusted when it comes to women and when it comes to violence against women, domestic abuse, sexual violence. Question is, how do you fix that? And what, firstly, let's get to the bottom of it, which is why I've called for an independent judicial inquiry, as we had after Stephen Lawrence. But if we can't have that, how do we rebuild trust? And how do we ensure that women feel safer? What the government's approach is, which is to introduce more street lighting, that just gives you more light to see your attacker. That doesn't deal with what's at the core of this, which is misogyny and hatred of women. And we've got to understand the police, like any community, will have these issues. But currently, it's police that's under the spotlight.
So that's what we're going to chat about next week. We've just spoken about Epstein, Maxwell and Prince Andrew. Hopefully everyone's enjoyed it. We've been open and honest. And I think, as usual, Nazir, the conversation between the two of us is very free flowing because, you know, we both just have not only views in relation to it, but we can back that up with our own experience.
We've lived it. I've prosecuted or supervised prosecution of maybe a million cases during my career, you know, through my teams. And hundreds of homicides, hundreds of sex offences, we've lived it. And so we need to, and we want to share what we think about these things, because I hope we can add value.
Brilliant. Well, listen, if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, first of many, we're here to stay. If you've enjoyed Fear or Favour, then drop us a message either through our social media platform or through the internet. We look forward to hearing from you. We will respond to every communication we have. Join us next week when we will be talking about Sarah Everard, Wayne Cousins, and the particular issues around women's safety. Thank you, Nazir. As ever, brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.